The 2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 172, LDS Film, Possibilities and Constraints. A panel featuring Gay Lynn Henderson, John Charles Duffy, D. Michael Martindale, and Eric Samuelson.
Looks like it's time to start. Welcome to our panel on LDS Film, Possibilities and Constraints. This session is sponsored by the Association for Mormon Letters. And just for your interest, I invite you to visit the table in the Autumn Room that the Association for Mormon Letters is sponsoring and pick up a brochure about our organization. It's an all-volunteer organization that promotes artistic work by, for, and about Mormons. We also put out a literary magazine, Irriantum, and you can see some samples of that magazine on our table in the room. A few years ago, it probably would have been very shocking to most of us to go to our local movie theater. Mine would be the American Fork Town Cinema and see a film about the LDS faith, or at least a film openly located in LDS culture. Now, we can see movies playing such as Charlie, The Other Side of Heaven, Singles Ward, The RM, Brigand City, and the film that started this trend, God's Army, and others that I haven't mentioned. When we took our family to see God's Army, I asked my 15-year-old son how he liked it, and he said, "I wished it could have gone on forever." He really liked it. I think, as I thought about it, I thought, it feels good to see our culture validated on the big secular screen. Another one of my sons was invited to a party recently to watch Singles Ward. I asked the girl holding the party if the kids had not already seen that movie, and she said, "Oh, yes. I've probably seen it 50 times. But we love to see it over and over," she said. And I wondered, why is that? So I want to ask, what cultural work is being accomplished in recent popular LDS film? What values are these films teaching my children? What constraints limit the development of this future genre? We have two presenters here today. It looks like Eric Samuelson is not going to make it, but that will be great because we'll have time for your questions and answers, and I'd be very interested in your questions and responses to our panel. And I'd be very interested in your reactions to some of these films. So you might want to share that with us. Our first speaker is John Charles Duffy. He is an instructor at the University of Utah, and he functions as one of the officers for the AML. And our second presenter is D. Michael Martindale. He is currently serving as film editor for Irriantum, and he also functions as the chair of the annual AML Writers Conference.
After Gay Lynn's introduction, I feel a little guilty. Gay Lynn has made very clear that the appearance of LDS cinema has been a much welcomed phenomenon by the LDS community, which I feel guilty about because I'm now going to be sort of a snooty academic and critical. But with that caveat, let's dive in. The title of my paper is Fellinis and Almodovars of Our Own: Can Mormon Filmmakers Break into the Canon? Orson F. Whitney famously predicted that the Latter-day Saints will yet have Miltons and Shakespeares of our own. This statement has inspired supporters of Mormon letters to hope that Latter-day Saints might break into the literary canon, that LDS writers might go down in history as ranking among the world's great playwrights, novelists, and poets. Now that we're seeing the beginnings of LDS cinema, that hope expands to contemplate the possibility that LDS filmmakers could break into the canon. Is that hope feasible? Could LDS filmmakers someday rank among the names of the world's great directors, names such as Bergman, Fellini, Kubrick, or Almodovar? To paraphrase Orson Whitney, could we someday have Fellinis and Almodovars of our own? My answer, unlikely. Before I go any further, let me explain what I'm not about to do. I am not going to argue that LDS cinema needs to meet higher aesthetic standards, or that LDS filmmakers or audiences need to achieve greater moral complexity. That argument has been made before in connection with other literary and artistic forms. I myself have made that argument in connection with film, and it looks like D. Michael is probably going to make an argument along those lines after I'm finished. But I'm not going to talk today in terms of aesthetic or moral complexity. I want to talk about cultural politics. My thesis is that LDS filmmakers have little hope of breaking into the canon because there exists an awful gulf between the cultural politics of Mormonism and the politics of canonization. The phrase awful gulf I take from Lehi's dream, which depicts the awful gulf that separates those gathered at the Tree of Life from those in the great and spacious building. I use that phrase because by the time I'm done, you may have concluded that it's actually a good thing that Latter-day Saints aren't likely to break into the film canon. You may conclude that the film canon isn't a club that LDS filmmakers have any business belonging to. What do I mean when I talk about the film canon? Canon is a religious term referring to the list of texts that a faith community esteems as scripture, what Latter-day Saints call the standard works. Literary scholars have borrowed the term to refer to the great books, or for our purposes here, the great films. There is no official body that decides which books or films are canonical, though some institutions aspire to play that role. The British film magazine Sight and Sound, for example, produces a top 10 list once a decade that enjoys considerable cachet. In fact, though, the canon's contents are decided by a loose consensus among critics and scholars. A good indication of which books are considered canonical is to see which books are taught regularly in English programs at universities nationwide. It wouldn't be hard for those of us in this room to compile a list of canonical authors off the top of our heads. They're the ones we had to read in school: Shakespeare, Milton, Austen, Eliot, Dickens, Dickinson, Hemingway, Faulkner, Welty, Morrison. The same goes for film. Canonical films are the ones that film programs nationwide present to students as models to build on or wrestle against. A roll call of canonical directors would include, as mentioned earlier, Bergman, Fellini, Kubrick, and Almodovar, plus names like Wells, Altman, Herzog, von Trier, Kurosawa, and more recently, Tarantino. What makes a book or film worthy of canonization? People outside literary studies, and a good number of people within literary studies, are under the impression that there is a set of objective, self-evident criteria by which great works are recognized as such, as if greatness were an inherent quality of certain books or poems or films. If you are one of those people, then I'm about to say something that will strike you as rank heresy. There is no such thing as an inherently or self-evidently great work. The process of canonization is political. Different individuals or groups promote different criteria for judging the relative merit of literary works. When certain individuals or groups come to occupy positions of influence and prestige, their criteria come to be the ones for deciding what's canonical. This means that the standards for canonicity change over time. To say that a certain work is canonical is not, as many people believe, to say that the work is timeless. On the contrary, to say that a work is canonical is to say that it is fashionable, or that it was at one time so fashionable that it has permanently ensconced itself into the history of literature, even if it would not be fashionable under the criteria that currently prevail. This means that when Latter-day Saints ask, when will we have Shakespeare's and Milton's of our own, they're asking the wrong question. No one today is producing Shakespeare's or Milton's of their own because the way Shakespeare and Milton wrote is no longer fashionable. It doesn't meet the current criteria for greatness. If someone today were to write a play in the style of Shakespeare or an epic in the style of Milton, with blank verse, lofty themes, eloquent speeches, and so on, their work would not make it into the canon. It might be admired as a clever resurrection of a lost art, but it would not become a work that students generations from now will be reading in their survey courses on English literature. So which works from our era will students be reading generations from now? In other words, what are the current criteria of greatness? What does a writer have to do in this day and age to get canonized? You have to do postmodernism. Academics have spent entire conferences arguing about what postmodernism is, but let me offer a working definition. Postmodernism is an intellectual movement that is both a product of and a reaction against the Enlightenment. Unlike the great minds of the Enlightenment, who strove to overcome prejudice, ignorance, and superstition through reasoned, objective, scientific inquiry, postmoderns don't believe that people are capable of objectivity. Postmodernism postulates that people's biases, preconceptions, culture, experiences, allegiances, or agendas inescapably shape the way they see the world. Postmoderns are therefore skeptical of absolute truth claims. There's no way you can know whether or not your views are the truth, because there's no way for you to stand back from your own biases in order to objectively assess your views. This is not to say that postmoderns are relativists. Relativists hold that because we can't know which take on truth is correct, we have to regard everyone's take on truth equally. Postmoderns, by contrast, see truth as political. Not all takes on truth are equal, because some takes enjoy more prestige and exercise greater power than others. For postmoderns, truth is not discovered. It's constructed by those who have the power to make their take on truth normative. Postmoderns seek to expose the constructed nature of oppressive takes on truth, that is, to deconstruct them. In art, deconstruction leads to works that are interested in fragmentation rather than unity, the margins rather than the center, the unexpected rather than the conventional. Because postmoderns hold that we can't have knowledge of things as they are, only particular representations of things as they are, postmodern art is preoccupied with the process of how representations get constructed. This leads postmodern artists to experiment boldly with their media, to find radical new ways to make representations, or ways to move away from representation, to rethink the very definitions of art or literature or film. There's often a dense critical theory behind postmodern art, which tends to make the work accessible only to those who have the theoretical background to appreciate what the artist is doing. When it comes to film, then, we're not talking about commercial film, though certain postmodern sensibilities have begun to trickle into Hollywood of late. Rather, we're talking about art house films, the kinds of films that you see as part of an international cinema program or on the Sundance Channel, the kinds of films whose trailers include laurel-wreathed announcements of the film's success at various foreign festivals, the kinds of films that often don't seem to be in a hurry to go anywhere and may leave you wondering, what the heck was that? These are the kinds of films that are currently making it into the canon. That's because these kinds of films reflect the philosophical, political, and aesthetic values of the cultural elite. Not everyone likes that fact, but let's hold that thought for later. The films that make up the newly emerging LDS cinema, God's Army, Brigham City, Singles Ward, The RM, Out of Step, Charlie, The Other Side of Heaven, are not calculated to appeal to the postmodern tastes of the cultural elite. These films are conventional in their narrative structure and cinematic technique, very well executed in some cases, but still predictable, unchallenging. These films unfold in a moral universe that is straightforward and unambiguous, where living church teachings assures a happy ending. We see comic relief and some self-parody in these films, but little irony. Even farces like The Singles Ward and The RM are ultimately earnest and reassuring, reinforcing the mainstream LDS worldview. There's no deconstruction in these films, no philosophical sophistication, little subtlety. The makers of these films look to Hollywood for their models and make few intellectual demands on audiences. In short, these aren't art house films. They're commercial films serving the needs of a niche market, mostly suburban Latter-day Saints looking for wholesome and perhaps inspiring entertainment about people like themselves. There's nothing in the new LDS cinema that would attract significant attention from the current cultural elite, that would invite the elite to take these films seriously as art. The postmodern cultural elite is not going to be interested in, for example, a film about LDS missionaries who, by faithfully carrying out the Lord's work, witness blessings in their own lives and the lives of others. The cultural elite might be interested in a film about American missionaries who experience a clash of cultures when they're called to serve in a third world country, though without the quasi-colonial romanticism of The Other Side of Heaven. They might be interested in a film made from the perspective of a non-American missionary, confronting a system dominated by American leaders and American values. They might be interested in a film about a sister missionary experiencing the ups and downs of coping with a system that tends to treat women as second class. They might be interested in a film that shows a missionary struggling with his faith, though without damning him the way God's Army does, or about a missionary struggling with homosexual attractions. Such a film has, in fact, just premiered at a Los Angeles gay lesbian film festival. They might be interested in a film that tries to convey the range and intensity of LDS missionary experience, but without schmaltz, by crafting images of missionary life into a kind of non-narrative cinematic poem. Or they might be interested in a film that depicts the mundaneness or the tedium of missionary life, as opposed to the more dramatic, humorous, or otherwise memorable events that are typically the focus of missionary narratives. These are examples of how LDS missionary experience could be represented in film in ways that reflect postmodern sensibilities and thus have a chance of being taken seriously by the cultural elite who control the process of canonization. I'm pessimistic, however, about the likelihood that LDS filmmakers will ever create works of the kind I've just imagined. The reason for my pessimism is that, unlike other observers of Mormon letters, I don't believe that what holds LDS writers back from creating serious literature is an aesthetic or moral immaturity that we can anticipate they will eventually grow out of. As I see it, the problem is political. Latter-day Saints are a conservative people, politically, socially, morally, aesthetically, and culturally, which means that the dominant cultural politics of Mormonism are fundamentally at odds with the politics of canonization, that is, with postmodernism. Cultural conservatives rail against postmodernism. They protest that the great books of the past, the books that form the keystone of Western civilization, have been eclipsed by contemporary works whose chief virtue is that they are politically correct. They fume about the moral ambiguity, the aesthetic bankruptcy, the pretentious abstruseness of postmodern art. At stake, ultimately, is the question of truth. Cultural conservatives believe in absolute truth. They believe it has been communicated to them through scripture or the Western tradition or reason discourse. They see postmodernism as an assault on truth, faith, and reason. The deconstruction of traditional values and precepts they warn threatens our society's moral fiber. Postmodernism's emphasis on fragmentation and disjuncture threatens our cultural unity. In the ongoing struggle between postmodernism and cultural conservatism, a struggle often referred to as the culture wars, Latter-day Saints have tended, not surprisingly, to position themselves on the conservative side. Brigham Young University is a bastion of cultural conservatism. General authorities have approvingly quoted or echoed or plagiarized prominent opponents of postmodernism, such as William Buckley, Richard John Neuhaus, and Gertrude Himmelfarb. As a people, then, the saints stand on the wrong side of the politics that currently control canonization, which pretty much guarantees our exclusion from the canon. Cultural conservatives would like to regain control of the politics of canonization, but that would require nothing short of a reactionary social revolution, which I don't foresee, nor do I expect to see the staunchly conservative LDS mainstream embrace postmodernism anytime soon. Now, it's possible that by this point you're thinking, why should we embrace postmodernism? Why should we want to make films that cater to the values of a postmodern cultural elite? If that's what the film canon is about, then the canon is a club LDS filmmakers should not belong to. As the Lord's people, we have different standards, and we will make films that meet those standards regardless of what the world considers praiseworthy. I'm not here to argue that LDS filmmakers ought to embrace postmodernism. I do, however, want to make clear that if they don't, we will never see an LDS filmmaker in the canon. There will never be an LDS Bergman or Kubrick. We will never have Fellini's or Almodovar's of our own. No doubt, the niche market for commercial LDS cinema will continue to thrive. An inventive LDS filmmaker might even pull off a successful commercial crossover on the model of My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which Eric Samuelson would have argued if he were here. But film students at universities around the country 50 years from now won't study the work of LDS directors as models to emulate or a foundation to build on. Whether you consider that regrettable or not is another matter. So in response to the question I started with, can Latter-day Saints hope to someday have Fellini's or Almodovar's of their own? The answer is no, because the Saints don't actually want Fellini's or Almodovar's of their own. They may want a Nia Vardalos of their own. They'd love a Steven Spielberg of their own. But Latter-day Saints with culturally conservative sensibilities are unlikely to regard Fellini's Satyricon or Almodovar's The Law of Desire as worthy of emulation. LDS filmmakers might envy the status Fellini and Almodovar enjoy, but the makers of God's Army, Singles Ward, Charlie, and the Book of Mormon movie don't seem interested in making the kinds of films that secured Fellini and Almodovar their status. And if there should arise LDS filmmakers with the postmodern sensibilities to create potentially canonical works, they'll probably find that mainstream saints are reluctant to claim them. The example of Neil LaBute is instructive here. LaBute is the best bet Latter-day Saints have right now for breaking into the film canon. Labute's early films, In the Company of Men and Your Friends and Neighbors, and his newest film, The Shape of Things, are in line with the postmodern sensibilities of the cultural elite. None of these films is explicitly LDS in theme, but I would argue that an LDS understanding of evil underlies them, and I would therefore argue for regarding these films as LDS cinema. Another Labute work, Bash, does have LDS characters, but I judge Bash to be prone to cliché and therefore an inferior work by canonical standards. My point is, even though Labute is the closest thing the LDS community has right now to a canonical filmmaker, Labute's position in the LDS community is precarious. Labute was disfellowshipped for creating LDS characters that his leaders felt presented the church in a negative light. And Labute has said that he now avoids writing about LDS characters in order to protect his church membership. Whether you think it's right or wrong, the church discipline Labute has faced as a result of his art serves to indicate why LDS filmmakers are unlikely to break into the canon. A community that is concerned about whether or not its filmmaker's work is faith-promoting or serves the church's missionary interests, a community where people debate whether it's ever acceptable to see an R-rated movie, is a community whose values are a world away from the values that currently control the film canon, for good or for ill. I confess that I regard it as ill. My Mormonism is a postmodern Mormonism. I embrace postmodernism because I see in it an indispensable constant reminder of the limitations of human knowledge. My politics are more in line with those of the cultural elite than they are with those of the LDS mainstream, which puts me at the margins of the LDS community, a position I don't mind. As a postmodern, I would be thrilled to see LDS filmmakers produce more canon-worthy work. I've seen a few short films by BYU students that reflect postmodern sensibilities in ways I find promising. But I don't really expect to see anything come of that promise, because I recognize that most saints do not share my enthusiasm for postmodern developments in culture, art, and letters. I anticipate that the saints will respond to their exclusion from the canon by creating their own canon, their own ways to validate and feed their basically conservative filmmakers. The awful gulf between LDS cinema and canonical cinema will persist, and most Latter-day Saints won't see anything wrong with that.
I'm in the unfortunate position of feeling like I may let down a few people here. Yesterday morning, I attended a workshop by Richard Dutcher, and then I had planned on putting together all the material I had gathered up for my topic for today and writing it up, except for the fact that some of the things that Richard said during his workshop made me realize that a fair amount of what I wanted to present was irrelevant. So I'm not going to present it, even though I know that there are some people here who wanted to hear that topic, and I'm assuming that our local celebrity is in the audience right now because he wanted to hear that topic. Instead, I'm going to present an article that appeared in the most recent Arianum, and here's a copy of it, which I think is a better article anyway, and is a topic that I more recently feel passionate about, as opposed to the one I chose a few months ago when I was first asked to do this. However, if there is a desire to hear the other topic, and since Eric Samuelson's not here, if there is an acclamation to do so, maybe I can present it later with any extra time that we have. But for now, the title of my topic is The Legacy of Legacy, which is referring to the church film legacy. With my ape, let me get my visual aids out here so I can access them easily. With my April issue of The Ensign, a new church DVD showed up. A new approach in missionary work, a new church film. I immediately plugged it into my DVD player, even before reading the article explaining what it was all about. I get apprehensive whenever the church puts out another film. But I tried very hard to withhold judgment until I viewed it. My apprehension stems from the legacy of the trend started with the film Legacy. That film was the first real attempt the church made to produce a quality, state-of-the-art film for general consumption. It started a trend of films geared toward reaching out to the public for proselyting purposes, a trend whose count is now up to 3 with this latest DVD edition. The clear purpose of these films is to pique interest in viewers to learn more about the gospel. This is important to keep in mind as we consider them. It is the vital ingredient in determining whether the films are effective or not. For indeed, they are films meant to be effective. Why else spend precious tithing money to produce them? Legacy, as the first of such films, stirred a bit of excitement. A cool movie from the church, for once. They even built its own theater in the one-time Hotel Utah, now the Joseph Smith Memorial Building, and named the theater after the film. Sadly, Legacy is the best of the films so far. Sadly, for 2 reasons. One, the church should be getting better at this, not worse. And 2, Legacy was nothing to crow about in the first place. The biggest problem with Legacy was its scope. It bit off much more than a 52-minute film can chew. If it had had the time of a Ben-Hur or a Gone with the Wind, it could have had the potential for greatness. As it was more a sampling of a moving story rather than an actual moving story of the early few decades of the church as seen from the intimate viewpoint of a fictional family. If one can ignore the iconic portrayal of minor character Joseph Smith, as represented by a look-alike, but certainly not sound-alike, one hopes, bad actor, the film actually does a lot with the limited resources allotted to it. Of course, I may be biased, as I've had a crush on the starring actress Kathleen Beller for many years, but for a proselyting film produced by the church, Legacy actually does a decent job disguising the proselyting intent, passing itself off as an interesting story from American history that happens to be about a religious people. Sure, there were healing miracles. Sure, there was a conversion in England through the efforts of a preaching missionary. But you can't tell many stories about Mormons without these things cropping up now and then. And there were at least as many tribulations, human foibles, and crises of faith as there were inspiring spiritual moments. There was even a moment of sophisticated irony as the background music choir sung the words "All is well" from the hymn "Come, Come, Ye Saints," while the protagonist's covered wagon slips completely into the drink in a downpour. Sure, the history was one-sided, as some have criticized, leaving out virtually anything controversial. What does one expect from a church film? That's perfectly justifiable from an artistic standpoint. The film tried to do too much already. Its theme was the trials of the early Mormons, not historical controversy. But it also indulged in a refreshing love triangle subplot where the dangerous, by church standards, love interest won out over the bland but archetypically righteous and bespectacled man of God. The heroine had a crisis of faith. Her brother had a crisis of faith. Her husband had a crisis of faith. Practically everyone had their turn at a crisis of faith. And if all these crises were resolved quickly in the next scene, one has to blame, once again, the limits of time, not necessarily the filmmakers. Legacy was not a great film, but it could have been, had it been given the necessary resources. Then one day, the church released Legacy on video and replaced it in the theater with the Testaments of One Fold and One Shepherd. Happily, the theater's name was not changed to Testaments Theater. Where Legacy was competent in its technical quality, minus the obvious matte painting of the Nauvoo Temple, T- Testaments was positively blockbuster in its quality and cool disaster effects. But that's where the improvements end. You can't even enter the theater without a sure knowledge that you are here to be converted. Where Legacy kept the proselyting tents of the church in the background, the Testament's environment reeked of proselyting with a capital P. From numerous pre-film, spirit-inviting speeches by missionaries to the exit music that continued to play after fade to black while the light slowly rose, the proselyting intent of the church was more naked than a colony full of nudists. The Spirit doesn't work on you while you view Testaments. It slaps you upside the head. The story is about some Nephites or Lamanites or whatever, who could tell. They are divided up into believers and disciples of the villainous cohort. Jacob is the son of Helam, a prominent believer. But, surprise, surprise, Jacob has doubts and is courted by Kohor to be his right-hand man because he's such a good artist, or in pseudo-Nephite Lamanite lingo, artisan. He can carve the mighty jaguar well, and for some reason that matters to Kohor. Jacob is also in love with a non-believer's daughter who, surprise, surprise, becomes a believer with the ease of a Jack Whalen character, and who sports the occasional tear tracks on her cheeks to prove it. As the medicine man, I mean the presiding believer, preaches. Things play out as the Book of Mormon says it does. The government falls apart, tribal kings arise, intercut with standard issue scenes of the life of Christ, complete with direct quotes from the King James Version of the New Testament as the only dialogue. Because that's just too sacred a story to actually make seem real. The crucifixion scene was okay, but Franco Zeffirelli's miniseries Jesus of Nazareth has a much better one. Then the Savior appears to the Nephites, Lamanites, Samoans, Navajo, whatever they were. This is just about the tackiest rendition of a dramatic scene I have ever witnessed. We're running long, Keith. We need to cut somewhere. That's the most charitable interpretation I can give to director Keith Merrill's motives for presenting this scene the way he did. A couple quick mumbles to depict God's voice coming from heaven, but not understood by the people, then a clear quote of God's words, a bright shaft of light, and a quick light-footed descent on wires by the Lord, and it's over. One of the most important scenes in the history of mankind. Marvelous anticlimax. The one shining moment in the film was at the end when some fine filmmaking and some fine acting by Rick Macy as Helam, also seen in Brigham City, Little Secrets, and Out of Step, actually evokes an honest emotional reaction. But perhaps the most irritating part of Testaments is the portrayal of Jesus. I'm sure Danish actor Tomas Kofod did his best. It wasn't his fault. He should never have been cast in this role in the first place. A baby-faced Aryan Jesus, that alone would earn Testaments a thumbs down. Well, 3 years have passed since then, and my disgruntlement at the church's foray into filmmaking has settled into the background. Until I leafed through the mail and found a strange attachment to my copy of the April Enzyme, a DVD sent to every subscriber titled Finding Faith in Christ, which I'll show you again. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. This was something I had to check out. I fired it up and sat back to watch. I wanted desperately to like what appeared on the screen. Truly, I did. Who wouldn't want their church to produce something to be proud of? The film opens with a dramatic scene of a fishing boat tossed on the stormy waves of the Sea of Galilee. As with the other two films, the technical quality of Finding Faith is admirable. The tone of the film is established right away. More scenes from the life of Christ, like Testaments, with dialogue lifted verbatim from the scriptures. Just how much like Testaments, I was about to find out. for the camera focuses on Jesus, and I cry out in dread. No, it can't be. One of my greatest fears is realized. The Aryan Jesus is back. There are no credits, as with all church films, so I can't be 100% sure, but it certainly looks like that baby-faced Dane Thomas Kofod. I guess this is what they call job security, if you can stand being typecast. Forevermore, Kofod will be cast as Jesus in every church film, at least as long as he can pass himself off as a 30-something individual. In fact, everything seems lifted from Testaments. The same motif of scenes from Christ's life, uninspired and by the numbers, with nothing but swelling music to invoke any emotion. And look there, isn't that the same John the Baptist as in Testaments? It's hard to be sure through all that fake beard, but it sure looks like actor John Georgi Enos, best known as Ed Gray in Brigham City. For all I know, these are actual clips from Testaments recycled. I only saw the film once, and it has been 3 years. But these scenes are the better half of Finding Faith. This time, the original and fictitious plot interwoven with scenes from the life of Christ is absolutely horrendous. The idea is actually clever and fraught with potential. Thomas the Doubter, after receiving his conversion by sight, now has to confront a doubter like himself and teach him faith without being able to see the resurrected Christ. But is the church-sponsored screenplay up to the task of developing the potential of this concept? Is the Pope Jewish? Rehashed strawman arguments about faith are what pass as inspiring debate here. The same sort of thing the church has been grinding out for years in their productions. And it's hard to tell if it's the stilted dialogue in the script, or just bad acting, or both, that makes these scenes tedious and embarrassing. I vote for the script. Laurence Olivier couldn't salvage this dialogue. The screenwriter subscribes to the tenet that reverential dialogue and contractions cannot coexist. Brent Spiner managed to pull it off as Star Trek's Data, but I don't recall any other example of an actor who could make contraction-free dialogue sound natural. Then there's the apparently obligatory cute little girl that has become a standard tool in the church's arsenal for tugging at the old heartstrings. Who could resist the wide-eyed cherubic glow of such an angel and not immediately call for the elders? That's what chafes me about these films. Their purpose is to proselyte. It's bluntly stated in the case of Finding Faith, both in the magazine and on the DVD. Not even a feeble attempt to hide it this time. The purpose of this DVD, says the Ensign article, is for we members to pass it around to our friends and get them to talk to us about Mormonism. Apparently, it's no longer good enough to wait for prospects to come to Salt Lake City and get their dose of inspiration in the Legacy Theater. We are now supposed to don our every member missionary hats and take the film to the masses. But the church isn't even counting on that. Accompanying this project was a nationwide ad campaign trying to get the masses to come to their LDS neighbors' doors and ask to see the thing. This scheme is, in fact, big stuff. All of which would be fine with me, except for one small detail. The film is embarrassingly lame, and I would never share it with any of my friends. Embarrassing to a depth that disturbs me. Not because it's deeply embarrassing objectively. It's standard issue church stuff. Embarrassing because this is the Church of Jesus Christ, the official representative of the Savior on earth. And in a big, expensive, continent-wide push to spread the good news, this is the best they can come up with. The good news of the redemption of Jesus Christ is a powerful message, virtually by definition the most powerful story in existence. And the church which represents him and his message can't come up with anything cinematically more inspiring than some run-of-the-mill swelling music. What is wrong with this picture? I compare the healing scenes in Finding Faith with the healing scene in God's Army, and wonder why viewing an imaginary Mormon elder healing an imaginary investigator of injuries from an imaginary beating is orders of magnitude more powerful and emotionally inspiring than viewing the Creator of the universe performing healings that actually happened on people that actually lived who suffered from diseases they actually had. I compare the depictions of Christ's life in Finding Faith to the depictions in Franco Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth, and wonder why the supposedly apostate understanding of a Catholic about the meaning of Christ's mission is more powerful, more moving, more inspiring than the effort of the entire true Church of God. I also ask myself, what on earth is there in Finding Faith that will motivate anyone to seek out Mormons of all people for their introduction to Christ? There is nothing in the scenes of this film to make anyone care about what's happening, except for those whom Christ's miracles already matter. No developed character to care about, no meaningful, relevant conflicts to weave together into an arcing plot with a climax. There's nothing there but by-the-numbers images of New Testament events, presented as a disconnected montage with bit players going through the motions of people affected by Christ. The only viewers who will be moved by that are people who have already been affected by these stories. And that's Christians. But why, when there's nothing within the film to distinguish Mormons from any other Christian, why would they turn to Mormons to find insight into the God they've already accepted? Or if they've become casual about their faith and are inspired into recommitment, why would they attend a Mormon worship service instead of just going back to their own? At least Legacy and Testaments told uniquely Mormon stories, giving the viewer some reason to have their curiosity piqued about the LDS Church. Finding Faith could have been made by literally any Christian denomination. It's more of the same hypersensitivity over the claim that Mormons are not Christian. The Community of Christ, once known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, has all but turned its back on its legacy from Joseph Smith, from some of his most important teachings to the name he was inspired to give the church, right down to the very book he called the cornerstone of the religion he founded. The Reorganized Latter-day Saints have, apparently through embarrassment, become nothing more than another Christian denomination. Their unique legacy is now nothing more than a memory and a corkscrew temple they don't know what to do with. But the legitimate Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as we think of it, is doing the same thing in its own way. The Church appears to be de-emphasizing its own unique view of Christianity in a misguided effort to pummel the notion into everyone's heads, we are indeed Christians. The effort is misguided because it doesn't matter. The fraction of Christians who believe our uniqueness disqualifies us from being categorized as Christians will never change their mind, no matter what we do, unless we follow the path of the Community of Christ and renounce our uniqueness. And the rest of the Christian world doesn't care. They're happy to label us as Christians along with everyone else, even if they don't exactly accept the validity of our baptism, but we don't accept theirs either, so that's okay. Meanwhile, our missionary prospects have less and less reason to choose us over any other Christian denomination, whether they think of us as Christians or not. In spite of any aesthetic reasons to like or dislike the legacy films, the recent films of superior technical quality, whose purpose is to reach out and share the gospel with the world, they are ultimately failures. They fail because they do not fulfill their purposes. Legacy probably comes closest to succeeding, but tried to be too big for its own running time. Testaments is fun to watch, but too cornball in inverted members, then those films fulfill their purpose and are successful. But that's patently not their purpose. They are intended as proselyting tools. As proselyting tools, they fail because the church is so busy being respectable and inoffensive. All artistic power these productions might have to inspire is sapped away by sentimentality. The cinematic church powers that be don't know how to make a great movie. And the Savior deserves nothing less than great movies. And therefore, they only manage to crank out film after warm, fuzzy film that makes Mormons feel good, but has no power to reach out to people yet to be converted, except a receptive few who would probably be inspired to investigate the church if SpongeBob SquarePants played the Savior. This is the unfortunate legacy of Legacy, the so-so movie that started the illusion that the church could produce films with power to convert when all they can do is make converted Mormons cry.
I know these two like to be provocative, and I hope you're provoked. So come up to the mic and give us your response, your comments. I'll call on people, but let's, yeah.
Professor Duffy, I was hoping you could elaborate on some things. I didn't know about Neil LaBute even possibly being disfellowshipped. Could you talk more about that? Was it over Nurse Betty or something? One of his other movies you didn't mention. But you say you had trouble with the happily ever after Mary Poppins aspect, that just believe and everything works out and it's all never, never land happy, you know, whatever. I didn't get that feeling from Charlie or particularly Brigham City, one of my favorite movies. I mean, what did you expect? A very nasty ending where maybe the FBI agent would come in and he'd be hanging himself in the, you know, in his bishop's room or whatever. Would you like a different ending? Would that have, you know, been more grounded and realistic for you? Talk about those two movies, how you would have made them a little better. And, you know, for the subject matter there, I thought they did a pretty good job handling that.
First, in response to the question about LaBute, what I know about LaBute is just what has been reported in the news, primarily in the Tribune. The story that was reported was that after Bash, which is actually a play that was later done on HBO and involves some young LDS men who go and bash a gay man in Central Square or Central Park in New York. As a result of that film, according to the report, he was disfellowshipped. Actually, about a year ago, the rumor was going around through the AML that he'd been excommunicated for shacking up with some girl, but the news reports do not bear that out, so I'm not sure what's going on there. I don't know if he's currently in full standing, but I think he's trying to get it back. That's my understanding. I feel bad even saying this on tape, because I'm probably spreading, you know, who knows what rumors I'm spreading now. As a result of the, or in response to your second question, I confess I have not seen Charlie. What I saw of the trailers kind of scared me off right off the bat. So I can't comment on Charlie. But let me say this about Brigham City, which is a film I've looked at earlier. Brigham City, let me go ahead and just, well, I've said this before, I'll say it now, though I've never said it with Dutcher in the room, so I feel a little weird. But let me go ahead and say it anyway. My sense of Dutcher as I watch his films is that he's smart enough to, he wants to position himself as a kind of a moderate. He wants to position himself as a kind of sophisticate. And so he presents himself as someone who's willing to look at troublesome areas, which is true. I mean, certainly he's come under fire by people who were bothered, for instance, that he showed a missionary sitting on a toilet, which tells you something about the conservatism of the community that he's trying to make his films for. But in all of his films so far, God's Army and Brigham City, my sense is that as he begins to move into this kind of risky territory, he very quickly retreats. And I saw that happen in Brigham City. I mean, Brigham City, the scene at the end with the sacrament meeting is quite powerful, and though schmaltzy, and it is, I think, the most creative use of the sacrament meeting that, well, not that I've ever seen a whole lot of other uses of the sacrament meeting in a film, but it's certainly a very creative use of the sacrament meeting. I mean, what he did there, the scene he constructed there was really quite creative. Though it created all kinds of weird ideological questions for me, which I won't get into here. But the point of that scene is to make everything happy at the end, to bring a sense of reconciliation and all once again being well. I've critiqued that film at much larger length in an article that appears in a back issue of Irriantum, if you want to see the whole critique. But it's basically along the lines of what I've said here, that the film tries to look sophisticated, but in the end ultimately reinforces a very black and white, we are good, the rest of the world is evil worldview. No, that would not have been, that would not have satisfied me anymore. What I mean, what I, from the point of view of canonicity, right, the kind of works that I would like to see LDS people producing, but they probably won't, are films that are ambiguous. The ending is sort of weird. A good analog, actually, for this would be the film The Good Girl. I can never remember the guy's name. Something White. It had Jennifer Aniston in it. It was an interesting film, I think, for Mormon filmmakers to look at because it's religious. I mean, White comes from a fundamentalist background. I don't think he's terribly fundamentalist anymore. But the film, The Good Girl, could be seen as, at one level, as a morality tale about the evils of adultery. But it's more complex than that, and it's somewhat more ambiguous than that. And the ending is ambiguous. I mean, you have to kind of see it to understand, but there's this strange sense that things haven't quite wrapped up the way, even though they kind of look like they're wrapping up. Ambiguity is something that LDS filmmakers, I don't think, however, are in a very good position to explore because LDS culture, conservative LDS culture, does not value ambiguity. And that's a real problem there. And if you're trying to make films for the mainstream market, which Dutcher certainly is doing, you don't want to be ambiguous. You want to reinforce cultural conservatism.
I should know about this. I've taped enough mission seminars myself. I'd like to know, where do we find this mythical canon that you speak of? And a canon usually has a list of those canonized elements. I don't know that... And again, why should we care?
Should I reread the paper? Well, you know, as I said in the paper, there's no set list of the canon. I mean, the literary canon is not like a religious canon in that sense. You know, there's no official body that decides which works are canonical. It's based on a loose consensus among scholars and critics. Like I say, the way to know what's canonical is just to see what is being taught at most film programs around the country as the great films that you should either emulate or wrestle against. Those are the ones to look at. So there's not like an official list. In response to the question, why should we care? Well, that's kind of, you know, as I point out in the paper, maybe most other things don't care, right? I mean, if you buy into a basically conservative worldview that says that, you know, we have our standards and the world has theirs and we're not interested in emulating the world's standards, then no, frankly, you won't be interested in producing canonical works. You know, I don't share that view, but, you know, I realize that I'm in a minority there. I'm a postmodern. I would love to see us producing a lot more films about ambiguity. There's a whole other paper for you, but let me try to, you know, in 5 minutes bear my testimony of postmodernism.
Or ambiguity.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have developed in the course of my life a worldview. I mean, I was raised in a home where my parents were LDS converts, and so we had a pretty conservative worldview as I was growing up. And then, you know, like many people here at the symposium, I reached a point in my life where I found that kind of dichotomous worldview, there are verities that are clear, things are in black and white, not a whole lot of gray, I found that less persuasive. Postmodernism saved my testimony at one point. At a time in my life when I was sort of giving up on faith, postmodernism made me realize that, you know, I don't have to have the kind of absolute proof that the Enlightenment wanted. And that's okay. You know, it's okay that I am committed to ideas because it's who I am. Right? And postmodernism sort of told me that's okay, because that's what we all do anyway. Eventually, of course, that idea took me in directions that the LDS mainstream would not approve of, but that's, I guess, why I value postmodernism. To me, postmodernism makes faith a valid way of living.
This is directed to Mr. Martindale. Along with you're talking about the videos being a proselyting tool, just a comment from me. I think those are a great way to introduce the gospel. And you know what? I don't think it's for them to convert. It's the Spirit, and for us to use that as a tool. But I share much of your views with the films. My question for you is: there's another proselyting movie out there. It's called "Until This End I Was Born," also known as The Lamb of God. It's a short film. It's about 20 minutes. I don't know if you consider that part of that genre you're talking about, the proselyting tools, but I find that a very good piece of work, and I want to know what your opinion and what your feelings about that film.
I can't answer your question because I haven't seen the film, but I can answer generally that I am singling out these three films because they kind of have had a special status in the church. They are a step above the other films that the church has produced. They're geared more towards a mass market, a larger audience. They're much more visible on the horizon. And for that reason, much better care should have been put into them to produce quality material. As far as your comment goes, yes, it's true, but the Spirit converts. No film is going to convert. The Spirit converts. But at the same time, we have an obligation. Every missionary knows that as they study the discussions, or I don't know what they do anymore. I guess they don't really do discussions in the same way I did, but to read and study the scriptures to become as effective communicators as possible. I don't know why, just because we have the Spirit on our side, that absolves us of the responsibility not to produce the best quality communication we can produce to get people to the point where the Spirit can work on them.
Before somebody else raises their hand, I just want to make my comment that I wanted to get in. You know, John Charles, I have to say that I think you're lumping things together for purposes of your argument, canonicity and Mormon film.
She's got
to be for example, I found Brigham City a very powerful film. And one of the reasons is because I think it asks some really tough questions about inclusiveness and exclusiveness. And when the bishop went to the bar to look for the bad guy, and we found out that isn't where the bad guy was. I mean, it really made me question my view about right and wrong and lines of black and white lines. And I think it stayed with me. I haven't seen it for a long time, but it's one that has haunted me. And I've had to rethink my reaction to it a number of times. Any other responses to some of the popular LDS film that's out there now? Or further questions or comments? Yes? Yes.
I have a couple of questions here. One for John Charles is, do you think that Legacy, if it came out on DVD in expanded form, longer time, could be a possibility, or is it the way it was made does not permit it to be expanded into a DVD that's longer?
Are you asking whether I think that the film could be canonical if it were made longer?
I just wonder, is it possible that maybe someday that the church will come out with Legacy in a DVD that is lives up to the potential that you seem to think was there? Okay, that's your question. Yeah. Okay, that's right. I got the wrong person. Yeah.
Well, if the church produced the extended version Legacy DVD, it's theoretically possible it could turn into a good, possibly a great movie, but I don't think it would, because art by committee, almost by definition, does not produce great art. And that's what church art is, at least up to this point.
Yeah. Okay, the other question I have is, and I don't all get an answer, but I'm just dying to know what Deutscher thinks of the comments made about Legacy Testament and Finding Faith in Jesus. I know you don't like to talk without being paid for it. Or maybe... Oh, that got him.
First of all, I'd sure like to know where that last comment came from. You're asking me about the church films.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. And you can't lump them all together. Again, you can't. In my opinion, you can't just lump them all together. In particular, you brought up the film Lamb of God, which, in my opinion, is the zenith, the best film that the church has produced. It's
It's a beautiful film. And then also a lot of the films that the church produces that most people never see, they're very instructional films or whatever. They're also good quality, very effective. A lot that are made for the youth. So to lump them all together and say the church makes bad movies, well, that's not true. Actually, if you compare them to Hollywood, they probably, you know, have a much better average of making good movies than Hollywood does. However, the big high-profile movies do have, in my opinion, some work to do. Not from a technical standpoint. Again, the technical standpoint, it's technically wonderful. But I have an interesting experience about this, and I'm not going to take up time because I came to listen, not to talk. But there was a film that the church made a few years ago about the construction of the Salt Lake Temple. And I saw this script because I was auditioning for an acting part in it. And it was a great script. And so I thought, wow, it was a great script. I read it and I thought, this is going to be a fantastic movie. And when I didn't get cast, I was kind of bummed out, you know. And then I finally saw the film, and something had happened in between the script that I had read until a year later when the film was done. And I don't, you know, there's probably lots of reasons that happened. But I remember being very disappointed at the end of that, because, and I think Michael made some allusions to this, where here was a film, the whole point of it was, look how, you know, nothing is too good for the Lord. You know, we want to give him our best. We're going to build this beautiful edifice. We're going to hire the best people, non-Mormons if we have to, whatever, in order to, you know, worship through architecture. And yet we made a film that we didn't bother to go out and get the best writers, the great writer, best directors, best actors, whatever. And to me it seemed like a strange message to be giving. You know, it's like, well, we were willing to do it then, but as far as filmmaking goes, we don't have the same attitude. And that's the same thing that I see in the, you know, Legacy and Testaments. I think those films, again, I go every time I go to the Legacy Theater, I think those should be the most beautiful, the most powerful movies on the planet should be in that theater, the most spiritually powerful movies. And I believe, being a Mormon, that we have the deepest, we have the ability to do that. And it does frustrate me when I go and see them, and I always come out thinking, doggone, you know, so much money and so much focus on something that didn't live up to what it should be. So, hope that answers.
I shouldn't.
You might as well sit up here, because I think we'll probably have more questions for you. We had a request from the next room that we're too loud, so we'll have to keep our voices down a bit, I guess, as long as we can hear. Yes. Would you like to come up to the mic?
I'm Peggy Sherlock. I'm going to be speaking on Saturday, but this isn't a commercial about me. I'm sitting here by my husband, Richard Sherlock, and asking, it just seems so obvious. Nobody seems to be addressing the fact that somebody really has to ask or demand the big existential question. How do we do it? How do we make the great films? Do we know that, how many of you know, raise your hand if you know that Mel Gibson is a Catholic, very devoutly Catholic, has a whole bunch of kids. Okay, more people than I would have guessed. How about John Voight went to Catholic University and worked with Father Gilbert Harkey? How many have even heard of Father Gilbert Harkey? Okay, Richard, thank you. But I just feel so, I'm hardly being very articulate about this. We, doggone it, we have to have the best. If you want to be a filmmaker and you're born, find out what the best films are. It's immaterial in a way. You go through the struggle. Give people what, develop your genius. Find out what the talents are, where your talents lie, what you're interested in. Write your head off. Find out what you got a passion for, what you would work and do, sell your body, whatever. I'm kidding there, please. Nobody wants this. this 60-year-old body, you can have this for nothing. But anyway, but what I'm trying to say is have a passion. I think we're kind of born, we're given these gifts. Heavens, isn't that what the church says? It's immaterial to me. I can go see a movie that maybe some people would say is offensive about Christ. I have a good, strong testimony of the church. Nothing offends me. I say, well, they're doing this quite well. Look, but I just say, when people say, like Ernest Wilkinson years ago when I was getting my master's in French literature at Brigham Young University, said, Brigham Young University will rise. You will see that we will become the Harvard and the Yale of the United States or something like that. But he never said how. And what we have to do, if we like filmmaking, and we have to consider it as an art and get beyond the church thing. Richard, do you want to add something? I think I've been totally terrible. Richard, give us a good ending.
I was interested in your paper. Does Hollywood make movies for the canon? No, the average Hollywood movie is not directed at the canon. It's just not. But I'm talking about some of the really good ones of the last few years. Schindler's List is true, and it's not morally ambiguous. I mean, the Schindler story isn't morally ambiguous to most people. He did what he had. The Schindler story, is it? Really? Saving people? When Ben Kingsley says, this list is pure good, doesn't just the human heart respond to that? No. I'm saying, it seems to me that even the best Hollywood movies aren't directed at the canon. Saving Private Ryan is not directed at ambiguity, it's directed at, you know. But, so I think this problem you're pointing to is not just a LDS filmmakers issue. It's a larger issue that there are, you know, people with great technical skills and great storytelling skills in films who aren't making. Mel Gibson does not make movies for the canon. Although this new movie of his on The Passion may make the canon just because of its controversy and its novelty. You all know the controversy about the Mel Gibson and what he's going to do. The movie is going to be, there's going to be Latin and Aramaic and then English subtitles, because Jesus and the apostles would have spoken Aramaic, and Pilate, a Roman, would have spoken Latin, and the Caiaphas would have known Latin to deal with Pilate, right? And that's not going to be a morally ambiguous movie, although the novelty of it. Mel Gibson calls himself a Catholic. The Catholic Church would call the sect he's following heretical. I mean, if you think there are ultra-conservative Mormons, you ain't seen nothing yet with the sect of. I mean, he's following. Anybody know Roman Catholicism? Where he's following Lefebvre's.
I thought the Catholics would see the priest reading it and
they
like it.
Oh yeah, they like it. But somebody said Mel Gibson's a Catholic, but he. Yeah. Well, but if you look at what Gibson, Mel Gibson. Everybody says he's a Roman Catholic. Well, he thinks he's a Catholic. But he's following, anybody know, Marcel Lefebvre, the renegade archbishop? That's Mel Gibson's group. The Latin Mass is the only Mass. Not that you can have a Latin Mass, but Latin Mass is the only Mass. And Vatican II was preaching here. I mean, according to the Lefebvre group, Vatican II is preaching heresy. So that's where Mel Gibson's spiritual heart is. The Mormon analogy, although it's not real good, would be Colorado City. Lefebvre was an archbishop, and John Paul II kicked him out of the Roman Catholic Church because he was preaching heresy. He was preaching that the Vatican II was not official doctrine.
And who cares? Good film, walk, praise him.
Yeah, but that's not a movie. What I'm saying, well, my point of all this is that all these movies, that Hollywood has this same tension of directing for the canon or directing for the masses, okay, the Schwarzenegger, all this, then directing for this kind of serious, Saving Private Ryan niche, and then directing for the canon. And I think they've gotten more conservative in the last few years in terms of not directing for the canon. I mean, if you look at a film like Midnight Cowboy, that's much more ambiguous than Saving Private Ryan, in my view.
We have scheduled until 6:15, so we still have plenty of time. Are there more people that have comments and questions that you'd like to get in? Okay, well, it looks like we do have a lot of people, so maybe we can keep it kind of short and let everybody get their say. Yes.
I'm just an amateur. I'm not involved in any kind. I'm just a film buff, and I love good movies. And my wife and I go to a lot of movies. And I think there's a lot of potential. As the church grows larger and larger, as it becomes more diverse, as it becomes more international, I think the that movie, The Other Side of Heaven, kind of deals with an aspect of the international church, and I think there's so much. To me, it seems like there's so much potential to make movies. Maybe they won't fit into what you consider the canon, but I think as the church grows and it becomes more international. I mean, I know Richard Deutscher is making a movie about a documentary about African Americans, which I had the opportunity to participate in an interview earlier on, and I'm eagerly awaiting that. It seems like a non-factual, non-documentary, fascinating non-documentary movie could be made by about somebody like Elijah Abel, taking based on the book that Margaret Young and Darius Gray, that three-volume trilogy that they wrote, and you mentioned Colorado City. I think with renewed interest because of the Krakauer book, it seems like I wouldn't be at all surprised if somebody lashes onto that. I don't know if it would come out to be a movie that would fit into the canon, but as you suggested, I think I think the possibilities and the fact that I live in near Fresno, California. I live in Visalia, California, and a lot of the movies that have been made, for LDS audiences have played in our area. Both of Richard's movies have played locally, as well as The Other Side of Heaven. The Singles Ward played locally, and so there is, there is that national distribution, and I think there's also the potential for maybe upping the quality and dealing with more ambiguous themes. I'm sorry to hear that Neil LaBute got what happened to him for doing Bash. I mean, that I guess it was just hit too close to the heart. But it'd be sad if other LDS movie makers are discouraged because of what happened to LaBute. I don't really have a question, but I don't know what you're... it's just my observations as a moviegoer.
I would like the panelists to address the question of what it means to talk about LDS film. Because I'm not sure I know what the term means, right? Because it seems that we speak about LDS film, and it can include members of the LDS Church who are making films, films that include LDS themes and content, films made by the church for official purposes. And I think that question, lurking behind that question, is a deeper question about maybe even the value of this conversation. Because if you look at other religious traditions, you don't talk about Catholic film or Baptist film, even though you have people from different religious traditions doing it. And so I think that this whole conversation is kind of based upon the kind of isolationism we've felt as a tradition from the start. So I'd like to hear your response.
First of all, that question reeks of postmodernism. Postmodernism. What is LDS cinema? Let's rethink the whole thing. No, you're absolutely right, though. That is a question that, well, it's a question people will talk endlessly about. People will go on talking about that forever. I do, however, just want to briefly endorse something you're suggesting, which is that I think the LDS community has not really looked very carefully at why it's even making film. I suspect that lurking behind the desire to have prominent filmmakers of our own, to have Shakespeare's and Milton's of our own, ultimately is a prosecutorial desire. It's a way of saying, you know, we're going to be out there, we're going to get our message out there, and the world will look at us and praise. You know, they will see that we have the truth and they will come to our light. I myself think that, well, I know, as a matter of politics, that that motivation will never produce canonical art, because that's not what the people who control the canon are at all interested in.
This question is also for you, John Charles. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems to me that you're making an assumption about what a person could count as a good film for her or him, that in which you can identify to some extent with the perspective of the filmmaker. And I'd like you to answer my challenge to that, because I watch the IFC all the time. I mean, I watch it way too much. I should be spending more time working rather than watching all these independent films. And although I don't share the perspective of most of the filmmakers of independent films, I mean, I share much more the perspective of Richard Dutcher or even maybe Mel Gibson than I do someone like Quentin Tarantino. I really thought Pulp Fiction was a good film. I really liked it, even though I cringed and found the characters all to be morally repugnant. I thought it was well made, and I was entertained by it, and it made me think. And yet, I couldn't identify with the I suppose in some sense I could identify with it, but I couldn't agree with the perspective of the filmmaker. But it seems to me that there's this assumption that that in order for a film to be good for me, I have to be able to identify with it ideologically. And since I'm a postmodernist, you know, I can only identify with these films that are postmodernist on IFC. I wonder if you could respond to that.
Well, the question of what films you identify with is completely and utterly irrelevant. When we're talking about canonicity, we're talking about politics. We're talking about what an elite values. Now, the question came earlier, where is the mythical canon? One could also ask, who is the mythical elite? Well, then we could go on having that conversation for a long time. Like I say, the point of my paper was not to make an argument that LDS filmmakers ought to embrace postmodernity, though I could on another occasion try to make that argument. But the point of that conclusion, though, was to point out the political problem. The LDS community, the LDS mainstream, is culturally conservative. The elites who control the politics of canonization are not. And as long as that situation is the same, you won't have LDS filmmakers in the canon. That's just a political reality.
Okay, I couldn't resist. John Charles, I do think it's interesting the names that you pulled out of the canon. The canon's pretty large, and not all of them are postmodernists, have that kind of worldview. So it's interesting to me that it seems like you've kind of created your own canon by which you're... Because the canon's quite large. We have our Bresson, we have Bergman, we have a lot of filmmakers who have more conservative worldviews than it seems like you do. So, as I was listening to your paper earlier, I found it somewhat deceptive in the fact that you seem to have created your own canon. Now, the metaphysical part, I mean, the postmodernist part, I can agree with that you're saying. You know, you would appreciate it if some of the filmmakers made postmodernist films or basically made films to enter into your canon. But I don't think that just because someone makes a film that doesn't have postmodern, even in these days, makes films that don't have postmodern elements in them, does not disqualify them from being ultimately a part of the canon.